from the heart of our nation's capital, this is Washington Watch Weekend Edition. Now, here's your host, David Salkeld.
This week on the Weekend Edition of Washington Watch, church leadership and healing, defunding the police, and why experts are ignoring the danger of puberty blockers. Greetings, fellow patriots. I am David Salkeld, and I'm a constitutional conservative, Christian husband, and homeschool dad. As the nation continues to try to find the path forward to racial reconciliation, Bishop Harry Jackson joined Washington Watch Live guest host Sarah Perry to discuss why the church needs to provide clear moral leadership in order for America to heal. Here's the senior pastor of Hope Christian Church in Beltsville, Maryland, Bishop Harry Jackson.
I think it's time to deal with these problems. I believe the church has got to rise up and begin to interact and lead the way, because when you don't have clear moral leadership,
yes,
like you did under King's day, he did a great job of holding the Bible in one hand and the church, in the black churches specifically, Constitution in the other hand, as he went out to various cities. He did an amazing job of founding, pioneering nonviolent protests. The church has got to lead the way.
Yes.
Or in King's day, it would have been that various Muslim groups would have risen up. Violence would have overflowed even more than it did back in those days. Retaliatory violence. So we need the voice of the church. We need opportunities to talk like you're talking now. And I do think that I need white evangelicals to speak to the pain of the black community, Sarah.
Yes.
The reality is you've got multiple generational wound.
Mm-hmm.
People like my children and my relatives who have children's children that are down in preteen age, many of these people feel that white America, even Christians, just don't care. Boom. Full stop. And because of that, it makes the emotional pain. Some of the people are operating as though they are under post-traumatic stress, living their lives. Mm. The black health rates are through the roof. More cancer, more heart disease, more diabetes, etc.
Yes.
Because many are living under stress. Now, I'm not trying to blame anybody. Nobody white in this generation caused this problem, but they have the privilege of attempting to fix it.
Yes. Yes,
think about
absolutely.
That. So it's going to get worse if we do nothing, but I think we can move strategically and say, I'm not sitting around trying to take unnecessary blame, but I am going to, if I'm a white evangelical American, I am going to take some action that just affirms the basic human humanity of people and the theological doctrine of Imago Dei, that every human being
mm-hmm.
the image of God, and thus no one can take someone's life unrighteously. It's out of the will. It doesn't say thou shalt not kill exactly in the old King James. It's what it says is thou shalt not murder.
Yes.
It's a place for perhaps execution through legal means. All kinds of justice. But just to blow out the candle of life on a man in the dirty streets of a city with no compassion at all, and to act like that's okay, that's not okay, and I think that's the generational, psychological, emotional, and even spiritual pain that is reverberating around the world.
Because at what point do you stand up and say enough? And it sounds like you really knew that this was different. This was an incident that was really going to spark a sea change, and I pray that it does. And I think you're right, Bishop, that the church writ large has to lead the charge. If anyone understands the nature of unequivocal love, of love for everyone, equal love, where the foot of the cross is level ground, for whom we have a universal hope and a savior, all of us together. It has to be us leading the charge on this.
You can find out more about Bishop Harry Jackson, as well as Arise, FRC's special update and time of prayer for the nation, when you visit tonyperkins.com. Also, look for a link to Tony's daily email update when you're there. And we'd encourage you to support our ongoing efforts with a financial gift when you visit tonyperkins.com and click on the donate link. That's tonyperkins.com.
We all can benefit from a good lecture. They can inform you and grow you. Well, Family Research Council's new weekly podcast features lectures by top thinkers from the archives of the FRC Speaker Series. Our podcast addresses issues like religious liberty, life, marriage, family, sexuality, public policy, and the culture, all from a biblical worldview. The Lecture Me podcast is available wherever podcasts are found, or visit frc.org/podcasts.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. On Tuesday of this week, as more and more people started calling for the defunding of police departments around the country, former District Attorney for the District of Columbia, Joe DiGenova, joined guest host Sarah Perry to talk about what the movement really wants.
Joe, welcome back.
Delighted to be with you.
Okay, I have so many things I want to discuss with this new approach toward managing your own social justice and your white privilege and your criminal inclinations. Here's where we are. This seems to be sort of the rhythm of the news being a crisis, followed by a provocation, followed by an overreaction. And here we are in overreaction phase. So cities like Minneapolis, do they, let's start with this, have the actual legal ability to eliminate whole departments altogether?
Well, that's a question of state law in Minnesota and city law in Minneapolis. And they can, as a matter of law, eliminate any government agency that they created. And if they want to abolish their police department, they can do so. But if they do that and they do not replace it with an institution that has the power and the force and the lawful authority to stop illegal activity, such as looting, rioting, arson, then the insurance rates in the city of Minneapolis will be either one, so high that no one can afford them, or two, insurance companies will not offer insurance in Minneapolis. So this is an experiment in communism. And I underscore, this is communism. What you are watching is a radical leftist agenda, which is anarchic in its origins. The American electorate has chosen a group of people at the local level, mostly funded by political campaigns funded by George Soros, which has at its core the destruction of the fundamental fabric of American society and displacing it with a radical version of America. This is, and I'm sad to say, I've said this for more than a year and a half, we are in a civil war, and it is a civil war for the fundamental rights of the American people and the Constitution. People are going to have to stand up. They're going to have to express their views that they will not tolerate this. And most importantly, they are going to have to vote.
Yes. Oh, we cannot stress that enough. And I will say this. I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second. I like to do that to give other people who may be listening in without the same perspective an opportunity to speak without actually speaking. In this case, I've seen plenty of very brightly colored and easily repeatable memes showing that this is simply a reallocation of funds. It's a moving of resources into social programs, welfare, housing. The thought being, if you elevate the populace itself, you won't actually have as many criminal incidents. What do you say about that?
Well, that's ludicrous. We have spent trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars since the Great Society program of Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s. And to what end? If you look at Chicago, 18 people murdered last weekend.
Mm-hmm.
85 people shot last weekend. Now, and those are black-on-black crimes. And the Great Society was directed at improving the lot of the black population. African Americans are very smart. They know that these programs have been a massive failure. The notion that we're going to shift some funds from the police department and increase spending on social programs is ridiculous.
Yes.
You couldn't spend more on social programs than we're spending right now. But one thing is certain. This is a serious movement, seriously funded by leftist, anarchist political operatives like George Soros. And it is clear they feel that they have the upper hand. And this is an inflection point in American history,
mm-hmm.
where we decide whether or not we are going to maintain the rule of law as
yes.
we have known it since the founding of our republic, or we are not.
2 points here about Minneapolis, I think, need to be taken away by the listeners here. The actual crime rate, after Jacob Frey took over as mayor of Minneapolis, he had a soft-on-crime approach from the outset. Carjackings were up 45%, homicides 60%, arson 58%, just from January through May 30th alone, from the last period, this same time last year. But he said, listen, you know, the union's playing an outsized role here. We understand Chauvin was problematic, but I'm up against a virtually impossible wall here. I can't jump it. I'm dealing with cops who are unionized, contract and arbitration prevent me from getting rid of these bad cops. So is the problem really with the unions?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that unions are part of the problem. I mean, if you look at this as a public administrator, my background is in law enforcement, naturally, and the law, but I am a political scientist by education. And one of the things that I studied was public administration, how you run cities and states and the federal government.
Hmm.
The worst thing that ever happened to this country was the institution of labor unions for public employees. It shifted a huge amount of power to basically a few people who mm-hmm. have the power to shut down government at any time they want to. Police unions generally are much better than that. They're pretty good. They rarely strike. They do what they have to do. But they do cause a problem in getting rid of bad cops. And that is something that the unions have to face. They have to decide that they have to be part of solving this problem. Otherwise, they are going to, in fact, be eliminated. I have no doubt that the left-wing governments in California, New York, New Jersey are going to make every effort they can. And the irony of this is that in destroying these departments by defunding them, and make no mistake, the transfer of money from a police department to a social program is defunding, whether mm-hmm. they like to describe it that way or not. The fact is that when you do that, the sure net result of that is going to be more crime in black neighborhoods, less protection for law-abiding citizens in black and minority neighborhoods. This is insanity. But that
Absolutely.
Is exactly what the people like Antifa want. They want civil discord. They want the society to fall apart because they believe, according to their own doctrine, that that's how they move in and take power.
Listen, it's not hard to predict the future here. Just a few days ago, an owner of a manufacturing company, Seven Sigma Inc., it's been in Minneapolis for 30 years. He's now moving his factory after law enforcement could not protect the plant from burning to the ground during the riots. So I anticipate you're going to see a mass exodus from these urban centers that are defunding or dismantling the police, which means your tax base has just dropped, which means you automatically can't fund whatever you have left in terms of law enforcement. I mean, really what they're doing mm-hmm. is they are perpetuating their own problem.
Well, this is what happens when you have anarchic behavior. When anarchists decide they're going to take the upper hand, when police departments are literally handcuffed by people like Jacob Frey, this, mm-hmm. this juvenile mayor of Minneapolis, and a crazy governor who is an embarrassment to watch, on television. He looks like a grade school teacher giving a lecture to children in explaining these public decisions. And he couldn't wait to turn it over to Keith Ellison to get this horrible thing off his back. It's an inflection point, no doubt about it.
You can find out more about Joe DiGenova when you visit TonyPerkins.com. We'd also encourage you to help FRC continue to produce this radio program with a financial gift when you visit TonyPerkins.com and click on the donate link at the bottom of the page. That's TonyPerkins.com.
What are you reading this season? Looking for timely and original commentary on human dignity, marriage, and religious liberty? We've got you covered at FRCblog.com. The content on our blog is written by policy experts, FRC staff, and outside contributors. Read about a range of topics from world abortion leaders exploit pandemic to advance self-managed abortions, and online outreach, how to continue fulfilling the Great Commission during the coronavirus. Stand for truth and stay informed at FRCblog.com.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. On Tuesday's program, guest host Sarah Perry and Wall Street Journal writer Abigail Schreier discussed her article on the intersection of the transgender movement and scientific research. Here's FRC's Director of Partnerships, Sarah Perry.
Abigail, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Okay, so the NHS in England revised guidance on synthetic hormones for children experiencing gender dysphoria, but only after the Tavistock Clinic was sued. Tavistock, for those of you who don't know, the only gender clinic in England. Do you think this is what it's going to need to take until we get to this point of common sense strictly on these drugs in America?
I think so. We now have eight... you know, there are eight bills in America in which they're trying to make puberty blockers illegal. And they've had to do this because scientists aren't engaging in honesty. I mean, look, I'm a journalist. I'm not an activist. My job is not to stop people from using puberty blockers on their children. My job is to tell the truth. And on this issue, not enough people are telling the truth. And the truth is, as Tavistock has now come clean about, we have no idea what the long-term effects of these drugs will be.
And from the outset, it seems that there has been sort of a rush to medicalization of these kids. And my thought is that this sort of comports with what we were seeing in the societal trend, that as soon as transgenderism became sort of this wave in the media and there was increasing visibility and there were calls for medicalization of children, there was an increased use of these particular hormones, puberty blockers, without really knowing what the long-term effects were, which it's heartbreaking. As a mother, I think if my daughter, my teenage daughter, were subjected to long-term medication use without a physician giving me full disclosure of what the risks were, I would be devastated and, quite frankly, picking up the phone to call my lawyer.
That's right. We're going to see a lot of lawsuits. And the reason there is that doctors are being activists rather than being doctors. So, you know, I've interviewed a lot of doctors on this topic, and they'll tell you that when they go to conferences, you know, whenever it's, you know, a new heart medicine or any other kind of medicine, there's an open discussion of risks and benefits, because all medications have risks and benefits. But when it comes to transgender medicine, and the one researcher I interviewed, she said it was like an infomercial for trans. In other words, no discussion of risks were ever assessed. And the problem is puberty blockers are a profound intervention, okay? They shut down the part of the puberty, that's the pituitary, that stimulates puberty, so that an 8, 9, 10-year-old will not go through the normal puberty. The sexual organs will remain the size and capacity of a small child. They will not have the potential for orgasm, and they may lose permanent fertility. You know, they may be permanently infertile. Profound interventions, not to mention that hormones shower the brain. So what we're doing is really an experiment that we don't know the long-term effects of, and patients aren't being advised of that.
Yes. And I'm also particularly concerned, like you mentioned, with the effects on mental health. You flood the brain with these cross-sex hormones for a child who maybe has an undiagnosed underlying mental health condition like depression, bipolar disorder, even high-functioning autism, which I know is the case sometimes for girls who present this way. One can only wonder what that kind of medical intervention does. So to that extent, I applaud the NHS for doing what it was legally responsible in doing, which is saying, okay, we can't say that it's fully reversible and there are no side effects. But I'm disheartened because there are so many gender clinics in the United States, and you're looking at a rash of lawsuits before the medical community writ large all comes together and says, okay, we need to do some actual scientific research on this. I don't think any of that exists.
Right. So in the past decade, we've gone from 2 gender clinics in the United States to well over 50. Some people say it's 65 and maybe, but Planned Parenthood now is one of the biggest dispersers of cross-sex hormones, testosterone. So as you mentioned, so first they put a small child on puberty blockers to block puberty, and then after a couple years, they put them on, as you mentioned, cross-sex hormones. Any child who goes from puberty blockers to cross-sex hormones will be permanently infertile. And the problem, as you mentioned, is we actually have no idea what the long-term risks are. And as I talk about in my book, and we have reason to believe that they are extremely severe and irreversible.
So I am of a mind, even though this hasn't been discussed much, that there is a very close nexus between prescribing these medications and the involvement of the pharmaceutical industry as a whole, because naturally both the doctors and the pharmaceutical companies stand to profit from increased use of these drugs. Obviously, I am not someone who has an issue generally with big pharma, but I can't help but think that there is a contributing role here.
Well, yeah, they are very pricey drugs. There's no question. They're very pricey drugs. And the Affordable Care Act, one of the things that it did was it made these drugs, you know, in some cases free for young people, and even the surgeries, very de minimis cost. So all of a sudden, these were really available. You could get these fancy surgeries, and it costs you almost nothing. You're unsurprisingly, you're seeing a lot greater demand for it.
I want to switch topics a little bit, and I want to talk about sort of the relationship between what we're seeing in the streets here and what we're seeing behind church doors. Apparently, as someone once said to me recently, COVID is no longer a thing because we are seeing throngs of people in the streets protesting, tens of thousands. In fact, the footage from Los Angeles is particularly jarring because it is an entire boulevard, down Sunset Boulevard, packed with individuals, absolutely shoulder to shoulder. And yet, so many houses of worship, whether they're churches or synagogues, they are all subject to these increasing, continuing regulations. We're all having to follow these phased reopenings, and it's 25% capacity or only 50% capacity. Talk a little bit about the double standard here, because I have to believe the media knows they're not being honest.
That's exactly right. I mean, my synagogue in Los Angeles has been closed now for 3 months. This is in a country founded on, you know, guaranteeing free exercise of religion to its inhabitants. We've been closed now for 3 months. Now that the new regulations allow us to reopen if we guarantee to only 25% capacity, there are no similar restrictions on other businesses, retail or other businesses. And the Supreme Court so far has allowed that. There was a Supreme Court order that allowed that. This is a disgrace, and it's one that the clergy really shouldn't have gone along with so completely. That doesn't mean that the clergy should not have practiced any kind of social distancing. I wasn't saying that, you know, that they should have defied orders, but they certainly should have, you know, offered more protest and more questions about, wait a second, why are the managers of Trader Joe's trusted to keep social distancing and we're not?
Right.
Something more important is on the line. And no one seemed to, you know, certainly none of these state and local executives seem to recognize that there are many parts of the First Amendment, and you know, the very first right in the First Amendment is free exercise.
You know, I actually found it very compelling. You made in your recent Wall Street Journal op-ed, you made the argument really that a lot of these religious leaders did not protest loudly enough, if at all. And I have to tell you, I'm guilty, because when this came out, when we were hearing word of a pandemic, as somebody who's immune compromised and has a child who's immune compromised, I immediately thought, oh, you know, we got to bar the doors. So I understood our church was extremely responsive in getting everything online. I go to a church with, you know, all the high tech bells and whistles. But I look now in retrospect and I think, I wonder if we just jumped too quickly. And now that we see the double standard in the media between what we're seeing in New York and Los Angeles and what we're seeing in Dallas and Minneapolis, and there are tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of individuals in the streets, I'm not compelled by an answer like that of Mayor Bill de Blasio when he said, you know, this, we're protesting something that has a 400-year history in the United States, and kind of all bets were off, was his approach. And I'm thinking, okay, well, we also have a constitution that's been around for a couple hundred years. So at what point does one outweigh the other? I mean, you hate to minimize it down to that level of calculus, but it really is ridiculous that he can say that with a straight face.
That's exactly right. I mean, look, we all did it. We shut down our synagogues, our houses of worship, because the last thing we wanted was to put lives in danger, all right?
Right.
But the problem came when we naively assumed that the state and local executives will be honest and allow us to reopen. I mean, they wanted to extend this as long as possible because, frankly, they were more interested in their pet issues, and they considered, you know, religious observance really a hobby that sort of we could do without.
Right.
They made no bones about it. They were quite honest. They were shutting down outdoor Jewish funerals in New York.
Right.
I mean, you know, people who responded to my Wall Street Journal column, they said, well, you could have just had synagogue outside. Funny, we weren't allowed to do that in Los Angeles. We were specifically prohibited. We, you know, in New York, they broke up funerals.
Yes.
There was no reason for it. And I suspect they knew it.
Yes.
Certainly the local leaders knew it.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. And remember, you can find out about all of our guests at tonyperkins.com. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
Washington Watch Weekend Edition is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit tonyperkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.